all you diehards, Friday, late morning diehards. Yeah, thank you. Get this around here. Sort of anticlimactic. I feel like the highlight of our worship, as it were, was with the entire program last evening. It's kind of hard to beat that, but we will persevere. You may have seen a pattern here. We covered three gates on one day and then four gates on the next. We've got five gates today. So what am I thinking? So we're continuing our journey around the walls and gates of Jerusalem, being rebuilt by so many enthusiastic brethren. In all likelihood, most of these laborers did not know everyone else that was working, but again, it was a joint effort. They all had different skills, but it was one labor. They were all eager to see the completion of their work when the final stone, beams, and gates are in place. So do we. The work was hard and tedious. There were trials from within and trials from without. But they kept building. And upon the principle of John, the 15th chapter, they and we build with even more vigor when trials abound. We left off last time at the Valley Gate, Dunk Court, and the Gate of the Fountain. We continue this morning with the Water Gate. Chapter 3, verse 26 of Nehemiah. Moreover, the Nethinims dwelt in Ophel, unto the place over against the water gate, toward the east, and the tower that lieth out. So the eighth gate of Jerusalem is the water gate, situated near the spring Gihon, hence water gate. So many lessons here that parallel the fountain gate, which is the seventh gate, as related to the water of the word. The Nethinim, a name we're now familiar with, worked and dwelt here in Ophel. Ophel is a risen area or ridge that lay between the Taropian Valley on the west and the Kedron Valley on the east. It stretched from between the spring Gihon to the northeast to the pool of Siloam that we talked about yesterday. Perhaps synonymous with what's called the stronghold of Zion. This ridgeline occupied a strategic position in defense of the city. It was, in fact, what we would originally call the area of the city of David, where the Jebusites built their fortress. And it was added to by a number of kings. We won't take time, but we can read about that in 2 Chronicles 27, and King Manasseh as well in 2 Chronicles 33. Who fortified this area as kind of a fortress of the city, the stronghold of Zion. And interestingly, the subject that we've talked about before, Hezekiah's tunnel, that's kind of a sectional through Ophel there, from Gihon down to the Pool of Siloam. So Hezekiah's tunnel would have been hewn right through this ridge of limestone. So the waters of, so you have to kind of, when you look at these things physically in the city of Jerusalem, or any of the details of scripture, the physical things that are going on, always think of the different layers of why is Yahweh giving us this information? Okay, so this Hezekiah's tunnel goes through the rock. So what? Well, we have to think about these things as layers of Yahweh teaching us information that is not otherwise contained in the text. Okay? The scriptures are an interpretation of themselves and contain so much information that it just would not be possible for us to comprehend if it was all laid out in black and white. Because, you know, like it's recorded elsewhere, the number of volumes would fill the planet. So we've got to dig these things out for ourselves. Alright, so this tunnel stretched from the spring of Gihon to the pool of Siloam, synonymous with the stronghold of Zion. So Hezekiah built this tunnel. It flows through the rock and deposits in the pool of Siloam. Thus, from the vicinity of the water gate to the fountain gate. So how do all these things fit together? Well, again, Nethinim, we talked about them before. mean dedicated or given. And remember, they were dedicated as hewers of wood, drawers of water. And Ophel means fortified or stronghold. All right. So I think it's safe to say for us that these Nethinim, talked about them already, typify Gentiles of all time who submit to the greater than David. They build the house. They offer the sacrifices of praise and thanksgiving. And they draw from the living waters. They dwell, spiritually speaking, in the stronghold of Zion, the household of God, through which, think about this, they're in the stronghold of Zion, through which the waters of life flow freely, and by which they are washed clean. A couple of scriptures on that thought. Psalm 51, 2-7. So none of the details that we are given in the scripture, names, places, architecture, none of it is random at all. Psalm 51, 2-7. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee only have I sinned, and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, in the hidden part thou shalt make me to know wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. So that's typically what's happening here with this water from the God, streaming from the Gihon to the Pool of Siloam through this stronghold in which these Nethinim dwell. Ephesians 5:26. That he might sanctify and cleanse it, speaking of the ecclesia, that's the bride that he desires, this virgin bride, and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. So again, typically speaking, that's what we see going on here. And I hope you perceive by now that, you know, as we go around the city, and see these gates, there's a progression, and that progression is most simply outlined in the handout that I gave to you. But that's just one layer. That's a logical progression. It's easy to follow, but there's multiple layers in each of these places that we stop. And so some of the details or the layers might seem out of order. So let's just harken back to a minute to the dung port, you know, where we see that's, you know, where literally, they threw out the garbage of the city into the Valley of Hinnom. Took the dung from the animal sacrifices, the skins, and pointed them out to the Valley of Hinnom. That's where we cast out the refuse of our lives out of our temple environs. But there was another layer there too. There was not only just the crushing of the will of the flesh, that potter's vessel to be broken, but in another layer, there was the ultimate change from flesh to spirit. The breaking of that clay vessel ultimately typified in that account of Gideon and a change to spirit light. So you might think, well, that's out of order because we haven't even gotten to the fountain gate at that point. Well, again, there's multiple layers to each of these places that we go, but there is a progression of thought as you move around. So I hope that's clear. All right, verse 27 of chapter 3. After them, the Tekoites repaired another piece over against the great tower that lieth out even into the wall of Ophel. So the Tekoites are a lively group who also labored in the vicinity of the fish gate, recorded back in verse 5, and they were establishing an important family legacy. They did not all have to build in the same place or accomplish the same thing, but they were all busily working on the house. Their name is derived from a Hebrew root meaning trumpet. As such, they loudly proclaim their allegiance to the house of God, not merely through words, but deeds. Psalm 47, verse 5. If you'd like to turn there. God is gone up with a shout, Yahweh with the sound of a trumpet. So that's how we manifest God, is we sound forth the principles of God through the things that we say and do and think. Psalm 98, verse 6. Psalm 98, verse 6. With trumpets and the sound of a cornet, make a joyful noise before Yahweh the King. Again, we can harken back to last evening. I think that's exactly what we did in a very literal sense. And hopefully we can carry that forth in our thoughts and deeds in the future. Well, what else do we know about the Tekoites? Their home territory of Tekoa was about 12 miles south of Jerusalem on the border of the Judean desert, close to Bethlehem. It was a defensive city in the portion allotted to the tribe of Judah, and it was the hometown of Amos the prophet, who gathered fruit in a region which abounded with sycamore trees. The sycamore was a type of fig, specifically the fig mulberry, a smaller and less sweet species than the true fig that we're familiar with. Typically speaking, however, the Bible shows that both good or bad figs represent persons. They can come forth and they can trumpet their cause before the Almighty for weal or woe. For example, this is the type of fruit, that fruit tree, that Zacchaeus climbed up in to see the Lord's approach in Jericho. Here was an example of one who, unlike the scribes and the Pharisees, showed forth his faith throughout his manner of life. Albeit, like the Lord himself, Zacchaeus was set at naught by the leaders as someone less than worthy of salvation. Another example, Ira, the son of Ikesh, one of David's mighty men, was from Tekoa. His name means wakefulness, as one opening the eyes. He was a good fig, we would say. Another example, in 2 Samuel 14, we see there's a woman from Tekoa, the wise woman who, at the instigation of Joab, persuaded David to pardon Absalom. She was a bad fig, allowing herself to be influenced by the murderous Joab, a deception that resulted in treason, civil war, and the loss of thousands of lives, including Absalom himself. Lesson here, choices and pursuits have good or bad results, depending upon what we trumpet forth, what we proclaim and act upon. May we each be like one of the Tekoites, working quietly under Nehemiah, or like Ira, a mighty man of David, and be reckoned with those who are allied to the beloved and demonstrate our faith in the way we live. Let's look at James 1, 22-24. But be ye doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if ye be a hearer of the word, and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in the glass. For he beholdeth himself, and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. So the Tekoites were doers. They were workers. They listened to Nehemiah's instructions. They carried them forth. Verse 28, Nehemiah chapter 3. From above the horse gate repaired the priests, every one over against his house. In this area, once again, we have a group of priests repairing the walls. The horse gate is thought possibly to derive its name from two sources. One, it may have been the main gate into which the ancient Jebusite fortress was entered, where people would dismount their beast of burden, their horse, and place their business before entering the city, or it is identified in several places in connection with the palace grounds. So it's possibly the gate nearest Solomon's stables that he built. In either case, the horse in Scripture, as related to the believer, is a symbol for what? Anybody?
Power.
War. Okay, but I think both of those are true. So a symbol of warfare. For us personally, we ought to see warfare against the flesh. But there's other things as well. Historically, this is perhaps no better typified than by the slaying of wicked Queen Athaliah at the word of Jehoiada the priest and the tearing down of her false system of worship. So let's turn back to that. I think it's I love reading that account. 2 Chronicles 23, and we'll just pick up a few verses there. 2 Chronicles 23, 12 to 17. Now when Athaliah heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she came to the people into the house of Yahweh, and she looked, and behold, the king stood at his pillar at the entering in, and the princes and the trumpets by the king, and all the people of the land rejoiced and sounded with trumpets, also the singers with instruments of music, and such as taught to sing praise. Then Athaliah rent her clothes and said, "Treason, treason." Then Jehoiada the priest brought out the captains of hundreds that were set over the host and said unto them, "Have her forth of the ranges, and whoso followeth her, let him be slain with the sword." For the priest said, "Slay her not in the house of Yahweh." So they laid hands on her, and when she was come to the entering of the horse gate by the king's house, they slew her there. And Jehoiada made a covenant between him and between all the people and between the king that they should be the Lord's people. Then all the people went to the house of Baal and break it down and break his altars and his images in pieces and slew Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. So in this record, we can appreciate two primary applications of the horse symbol. One personal and the other prophetic. On the personal side, there is again repeated, and we've seen this in several of the layers, again going all the way back to the old gate, putting off the old man of the flesh. The pottery gate, breaking the will of the flesh. And here again, the warfare against the flesh. The need for personal cleansing of our house in our warfare, our personal warfare. So let's just look at a couple of verses on that idea. More of the same, but I think it's always worth repeating. Romans 8, 3 and 4. For what the law could not do, and that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin condemned sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. 2 Corinthians 10, 4 and 5. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. And this has been, I think, referred to several times, but I think it's a good passage to have in our sheath, to unsheath when necessary. Casting down imaginations and every high thing that what? What does it do? Exalteth itself, just like Goliath in the Valley of Elah. It was blaspheming against God. It's not shy at all. It exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. We need to bring that captive, those thoughts that well up in us. Galatians 5, 16 and 17. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. So Paul is saying to the Galatians, this is what I'm telling you. If you walk in the Spirit, think about Nehemiah. When he's walking from that valley gate towards the fountain gate, walk in the Spirit. Keep your eyes focused upon this wall over here that you need to be building, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. You will not be venturing over here into the valley of Gehenna and doing what those people are doing. And you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. And here's the war for it. The warfare. The flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these two are what? contrary one to another, so you cannot do the things that you would. So there's a warfare going on here, or has to go on here, for us to succeed in this race. Ephesians 6, 12 and 13. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, having done all to stand. All right. So we're going to move along. But based upon Paul's note to Timothy in the next reference, he speaks of prophecy. We're not going to read that. But we move to the second aspect of warfare, that being prophetic. When the cherubim saints will war against the nations, bringing about the fall of the current system of Athaliah or Jezebel worship. She was the daughter of Jezebel. So this ultimate warfare, which is prophetic, will bring down that house of worship. Song of Solomon 1:9. Which you might think is an odd place to turn on this subject, but the Song of Solomon is full of all aspects of our spiritual lives. Song of Solomon 1:9. Speaking to the bride, the beloved says, the bridegroom says, I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses in Pharaoh's chariot. So this is the perfected bride, and she is compared to this company of horses that not only has to do personal warfare, but will ultimately do warfare on a worldwide stage. Habakkuk chapter 3, more directly in the prophetic sense. Habakkuk chapter 3. And we want to just pick out verses 13 to 15. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even for the salvation of thine anointed. So this is the Christ host marching up through the land to save Israel. Thou woundest the head out of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation into the neck, Selah. Thou didst strike through with his staves the head of his villages. They came out as a whirlwind to scatter me. Their rejoicing was as to devour the poor secretly. Thou didst walk through the sea with thine horses, through the heap of great water. So note here it says, you, multitudinous Christ, walked through the sea with your horses. Interesting phraseology. Who are these horses that he's talking about? So I hope this shows up. Not as well as I would like it to. So you're going to have to use your imagination here. But this is Zechariah's vision of the four chariots, recorded in Zechariah chapter 6, verses 1 to 5. And we have a similar vision in Revelation chapter 19, with Christ on a white horse, and the armies followed him on white horses. But in Zechariah 6, we have four chariots are mentioned first. Okay? And we think back to the Battle of Amalek, and we see a typical situation there, and Joshua's name is mentioned four times. What does Joshua mean? Same as Jesus. Yahweh's salvation. Salvation of Yah. So this is God manifest in the saints. The four carpenters. The four cherubim. The four chariots. The four living ones. That's what's happening here. This vision in chapter 6 is about Armageddon and beyond. So Armageddon begins with a conflict of powers over the Holy Land. I think it was Brother Perry had a slide of the Ptolemaic and Seleucid empires and how they come together and meet right there at the Holy Land. So this historical battle of powers of the flesh, these two mountains of brass, has been a constant throughout history. And even today, we see there's different interests in the Holy Land and concerning those countries round about Israel. And we see the Gog and Confederacy. Ultimately, we'll have Russia and Europe on one side, while we'll have Tarshish the young lions, Sheba and Dedan, representing the Arab Emirates, on the other. So two mountains of brass are both there for their own selfish reasons. They both, they're in contention one against the other. And out from between that problem, of which Israel's the center, come these four chariots. But there's something else with them. There's horses. Given that, what's wrong with this picture? I like to ask this question to my young Sunday school students. What's wrong with this picture?
Horses are in the chariot.
Yes, the horses are in the chariots. They're not pulling the chariots. Well, this is exactly what Zechariah depicts. The horses are carried by the chariots. Who are these horses? Let's turn over to Zechariah chapter 10. Zechariah chapter 10, verse 3. Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats. For Yahweh of armies has visited his flock of the house of Judah. So that connection has been made. Israel has been brought back into covenant and hath made them as his goodly horse in battle. That's who these horses are that we see in these chariots. So Yahweh is going to, in Zechariah chapter 9, we see them as the Judah bow and the Ephraim arrow. So there's going to be an Ephraim element ultimately brought back into this. But we have these horses are ultimately going to join with Christ and the saints. I think this is post-Armageddon in what we would call the 30 years war against the Babylonian Jezebel Athaliah system. And they're going to subdue it. So that is what we have here with these horses depicted in battle. To me, it's poetic justice against the world, which has hated and abused Israel for thousands of years. Okay. I could go on and on and on about that. But. All right. There we go, Zechariah 10:3. I forgot that was on the screen. We're going to move on. After them repaired Zadok, verse 29, Nehemiah chapter 3. After them repaired Zadok, the son of Immer, over against his house. After him repaired also Shemaiah, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the east gate. At this point in our journey, we are at the easternmost segment of the wall of the city of Jerusalem. It seems appropriate then that a priest by the name of Zadok, the son of Immer, is working here. So Zadok, as we know, means just, the righteous. Immer, from a root Amar, means appoint. The most notable Zadok was a faithful high priest serving in the time of King David and Solomon. It was he who assisted David during the revolt of Absalom and later assisted in bringing Solomon to the throne. He was the first high priest serving in the temple that Solomon built with Yahweh. While this most notable Zadok was long deceased by the time of Nehemiah, the sons of Zadok carried on in the priestly line. Here, on the east side of the city, Zadok labored. We know that it is from the east that the future Messiah, the Prince, the King of Israel, will approach the city of Jerusalem in his triumphant entry at the time of the end. Thus, we suggest to you that the East Gate represents, in the sequence of all the gates, the coming of Christ and his revelation to the world. Let's go back to Isaiah 41, 1 and 2. This is speaking historically of Cyrus, but we know that Cyrus in his destruction of Babylon is a type of what the Lord will do. Keep silence before me, O islands, and let the people renew their strength. Let them come near, and let them speak. Let us come near together to judgment. Who raised up the righteous man from the east? Who called him to his foot, gave the nations before him, made him rule over kings? He gave them as dust to the sword, and as driven stubble to his bow. So that certainly conjures up thoughts about Nebuchadnezzar's image. So this is Cyrus historically, but it's Christ and the saints prophetically. Okay, Zechariah 14:4. And on that way into Jerusalem and the conquering of the northern invader, and his feet shall stand in that day, the day spoken of in the first verse, in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. So again, the thought is that the east is the direction Messiah comes, and we see that alluded to also in the Olivet prophecy, speaking initially about the Romans invading the land, but prophetically it's regarding the second coming also. I'm going the wrong direction, Matthew 24. Verse 27. For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even to the west, so also the coming of the Son of Man shall be. So moreover, it is from the east that the future Messiah, the Prince, the King of Israel, will approach the temple city of Ezekiel's prophecy. There, the antitypical sons of Zadok, or the immortalized saints, will be appointed to minister. And we see that in Ezekiel 46, verse 12. We'll turn there. Ezekiel 46, verse 12. Now when the prince shall prepare a voluntary burnt offering or peace offerings voluntary unto Yahweh, one shall then open him the gate that looketh toward the east. And he shall prepare his burnt offering and his peace offerings as he did on the Sabbath day. Then shall he go forth, and after his going forth, one shall shut the gate. And we also see the sons of Zadok specifically, typically representing the saints in chapter 44. And we'll take the time to read that. So in this area near the gate repaired Shimeiah, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the gate. Shimeiah means Yah hath heard. Shechaniah means Yah hath dwelt. Both of these men, interestingly, are believed to be direct descendants of King David, based upon 1 Chronicles chapter 3 and Luke chapter 3. So how appropriate that such as these, we have those, I think, representing the spiritual descendants of David, toiling side by side with the priestly line in Zadok. Here we have a kingly and priestly lineage working together at the East Gate. I believe a foreshadowing of the immortal King Priest of the age to come, who will arise from the East. Let's look at Revelation 16:12. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the East might be prepared. So the Greek word here, Anatoly, translated east, doesn't just convey direction, but it actually conveys a rising of light, a dawn, a day spring. So why is that important to us? We'll turn back to Luke, the first chapter. Luke chapter 1, and we want to hone in on verse 76 to 79. And thou child shall be called the prophet of the highest. So this is speaking of John the Baptist. Thou child shall be called the prophet of the highest, for thou shalt go before the face of the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation unto his people, by the remission of their sins through the tender mercy of our God, whereby, take note, the day spring from on high hath visited us to give light to them that sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, and to guide our feet into a way of peace. So this is John the Baptist is sent as this person to introduce the day spring, the Son of Righteousness, the Christ. So I believe that that is what this here is referring to in Revelation. Okay. Time's flying. Next, lying between the east gate and the Mithkad gate was the prison gate. In the prison gate, following after Christ's return, we see those loosed from the pains of death and the grave. The resurrection of all those of the Abrahamic covenant from Adam into the Lord's return, and if approved, an exaltation to everlasting life. Freedom from sin and death. Zechariah 9:11. Zechariah 9, verse 11. As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant, I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit wherein is no water, signifying those who will be raised from the dead, and ultimately, if approved, giving everlasting life. Luke 20, 36. Neither can they die any more, for they are equal to the angels and are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. In 1 Peter 1, 3 and 4. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to his abundant mercy hath begotten us again into a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, and that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you, which are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time, wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through much manifold temptations. Okay. Move forward just a bit in verse 31, chapter 3 of Nehemiah. And after him repaired Malchiah of the goldsmith's sons unto the place of the Nethinims and of the merchants over against the gate Mithkad, or the muster, or the corner gate, into the going up of the corner. So at last we come to the 12th gate, the Mithkad, or muster, or corner gate. To muster means to gather together for inspection or action. Again, there's a progression. You know, you can see that in your handout on the simplest form. But again, there's layers here. So if some of these layers may seem out of order on the surface. All right, so just keep that in your back pocket. The saints of all ages will be raised and gathered together for inspection or judgment. And those approved will be, and this is what I think this gate is really typifying. They will be assembled. These approved saints will be assembled and gathered together for the activities marked out by the Christ multitude and the prophets. So there's going to be an immortal host that is redeemed, a bride that is perfected, and they are going to be mustered together and given instruction to carry out what we just talked about with those four chariots that are going out between two mountains of brass. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 5:10. One of these days I'll get a non-Bullinger Bible that has half the number of pages. 2 Corinthians 5:10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. Psalm 50, 3 to 5. Our God shall come and shall not keep silence. A fire shall devour before him, and it shall be very tempestuous round about him. He shall call to the heavens from above and to the earth, that he may judge his people. Gather my saints together unto me, those that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And while often we use this passage in context with the judgment seat spoken of there in 2 Corinthians 5, I believe this also represents that mustering together of the glorified saints that are going to accomplish the work that needs to be done. If you look through the entirety of this chapter, I think you get that context. Remember there in verse 1, the mighty God, even Yahweh, has spoken. Verse 2, out of Zion, remember those chariots we just looked at, out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God hath shined. So this immortalized multitude has been perfected, and they are being assembled for the work before them. Psalm 149:1. Sing unto Yahweh a new song, and his praise in the congregation, those that have been mustered together, of the saints. Verses 5 to 9. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth, and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute the vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honor have all his saints. Praise ye Yahweh. So here on this gate, as we're winding down here, we find laboring Melchiah, the son of the goldsmiths. And Melchiah means king of or appointed by Yah, and goldsmiths from the word signifying one who refines and purges away. Here, nearly at the completion of the journey around the city of peace, we appropriately find the son of him who purges away sin and death, the one appointed to be king. Isaiah 1, 25 to 27. Isaiah 1, 25. And I will turn my hand upon thee, and purge away thy dross, and take away thy tin, and I will restore thy judges as at the first, and thy counselors as at the beginning. Afterward thou shalt be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city, and Zion shall be redeemed with judgment, and her converts with righteousness. So I believe we have this individual here, Melchiah of the goldsmiths, representing that individual who's going to restore this righteousness to the city of Jerusalem. And beside him, we have yet another group of Nethinims, again meaning one given, the temple servants that we've spoken of before. So now they will serve in the future temple, as well as teaching the nations abroad regarding the covenants of promise. These Gentiles brought in the covenant, which we, as we've discussed, has relevance to our position. Isaiah 11, verse 6. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And also drop down to verse 10. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, and to it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. So the Gentiles are going to participate in this time, and the saints, many of who are Gentile descent, are going to participate in this as well. So here we have, let me go back and catch a few other verses here. We see in verse 8, the suckling child shall play on the hole of the asp, the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain of the earth, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And Verse 6 again, just to emphasize this, we see a little child shall lead them. So the prophet in this, we don't have time to read the whole chapter, unfortunately, but the prophet sees here the nations that will enter into the kingdom age represented as beasts, just as they are so represented in Daniel. But now, having been subdued, tamed, led by a child that is figurative, one representing those who are the children of God, the seed of Abraham, having inherited the promises and now leading the nations in the way of righteousness. All right, we're going to quickly move forward here in just with the few moments that we have left. In verse 32, in between the going up of the corner gate and to the sheep gate, prepared goldsmiths and the merchants. So interestingly, we've gone all the way around the city to the muster gate, which is the 12th gate, and yet the journey still continues. There's still something else to do here. In verse 32, we again have repeated the work of the goldsmiths, repeated the work of the merchants, even to the sheep gate, which is where we began our journey. This combination of those who typically have been purged from sin, the goldsmiths, and those who are both capable and worthy to teach others, the spice merchants, comes full circle to yet another flock. There will be the natural seed of Israel brought back into the covenant, having seen and accepted Jesus as the true Messiah and Lord over the flock of Israel, but not to be overlooked is the Gentile element of the kingdom, the nations who are left after the Battle of Armageddon, after the 30 years war with the beast. They too, like sheep gone astray, must be gathered and taught the truth. Let's look at Zechariah 8. And we're going to hone into verse 23. Thus saith Yahweh of armies, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is called a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. So again, that Gentile element is going to have to be taught. The Jews are going to have to be taught, and that is going to be the work of the saints, back to the sheep gate. So this will be the culmination of the building of the walls of Zion for the hidden period, or the Olam, spoken of in the prophets. We all began by being called to the sheep gate, then being caught in the gospel net, the fish gate. And remember, we reiterated the fact that that wasn't just a chance catching in the gate when we looked at that miracle in the Sea of Galilee. The fish were brought to the net. We put off the old man at the old gate. Afterwards, the Ephraim gate pretends are being fruitful in the Lord's vineyard. Yet, the valley gate reminds us that the way out from the throng of sin and death requires that we humble ourselves, that we cast off fear and the refuse of the carnal mind, the dung gate. Coming then swiftly to the waters of Shiloh that flow freely, the fountain gate, we drink all that we can, the water gate. Fortified and strengthened, we commit ourselves to fight the good fight of faith, the horse gate, and look eagerly towards the rising of the dawn, the Lord's return, the east gate. With the trump of God, the dead will be raised, and the faithful loosed from sin and death with a change of nature, the prison gate. The perfected brides will be gathered for inspection by their captain and set in order to complete the promise of the Abrahamic and Davidic covenants, the muster gate. The glorified saints with the ancients, having traveled the long road of trials of faith, building and sin purging, will finish the house and the city in the presence and under the tutelage of the greater than Nehemiah, Yahweh's comforter. The consolation of Yah will then be fulfilled, and the words of Nehemiah will be remembered. Remember us, O our God, for good. Thank you very much for your attention.